Hello, everyone. I'm Eugene Porter de Leon, at Porter de Leon on Twitter, and this is episode 125 of In Tech We Trust. On this show, we look at how technology companies can apply Clayton Christensen's jobs theory to change the way in which new products are developed.
Oftentimes, the better solution is not more complicated, is not more sophisticated technology. It's clarity and fewer things really squarely aimed at the job to be done.
And we see how bringing a product to market isn't something that just happens overnight. It often involves the blood, sweat, and tears of a small army of individuals.
You know, it's one of those things where it's like when you get so personally invested in the success of bringing something to market, you know, the recognition of that is something that sometimes gets lost for the people. So it's like, I always try to make sure that people on my team get a lot of like, hey, you know what, I love what you're all doing. I love the sacrifice. I appreciate it greatly. There needs to be more of that.
Finally, we discuss how certain natural behaviors within the IT industry tend to stifle the abilities of companies to create cultures that foster creativity, risk, and growth.
One thing that I think that we have to be aware of, especially within the IT industry and the technology industry, is that a lot of times we get ingrained in our trenches. We have our little ruts that we've developed, and we've optimized for a process, and we've worked really hard to improve that process without ever actually asking if maybe we should change the process or the scope of the process.
But let me ask you this question first. Have you ever won anything? Now, I'm not talking about a sporting event or a beer pong championship, which are true wins that require skill, talent, and a commitment over time, with the beer pong example being the obvious stretch of that definition, of course. I mean, have you ever won a raffle or maybe a game of bingo or a sweepstakes? Something that required no expertise, no skill, and no hard work at all. Just the random convergence of chaos theory, statistical probability, and good old-fashioned luck to be the beneficiary. Now, as you mull this over, you might want to consider why so many in the tech industry attribute the beneficiaries of market success, even startup founders themselves, consider their wins to be, in large part, in the hands of forces that they have no control over. Random market timing, waves of industry transformation, company culture convergence, magic beans, and who knows what else. The conventional tech wisdom has stated for years that 90% of startups fail. Are they just unfortunate casualties of fate? Though Fortune magazine states that this number is actually closer to 60% based on data from 2001 onward, this is still a large number. Did these companies forget to rub their rabbit's feet? Or was there simply a problem with the way in which they developed their product idea and executed on it? And that's the theme of our show, luck, and the role it plays in innovation. So do you think that launching a successful startup or hitting the market with that killer new app is a result of a keen understanding of the problem your customers are trying to solve and a consistently executed effort to that end? Or do you think it's more like winning the lottery? While the payouts may be similar, these two viewpoints are at opposite ends of the spectrum, with most people looking at the winners as they ring the opening bell on the NASDAQ on the day they go IPO and thinking, wow, they must have been lucky. But does luck really have anything to do with it? Well, here's what we found out.
In tech we trust. We're not sure about.
But first, we're joined by Karen Dillon, best-selling author and former editor of the Harvard Business Review, who is also the co-author, along with Clayton Christensen, of a fascinating book that just came out last year entitled Competing Against Luck. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
According to the book, innovation isn't just luck. A lot of people might think that. But there's actually a framework that's put forth in the book called Jobs Theory that explains how entrepreneurs can take a more, I guess, maybe scientific approach to creating the next great thing. Karen, could you explain Jobs Theory and how the book talks about that theory vis-a-vis technology innovation?
Sure. So let me just explain at a high level what Jobs Theory is. Jobs Theory is a theory that Clayton Christensen has been working on for really 20 years while he's been at Harvard Business School, because he was so frustrated to watch so many great companies spend a lot of money on innovation, And spend a lot of money on gathering data and crunching the numbers every possible way, but still being very disappointed with their innovation efforts, having a lot of hit and miss. And so the question he was trying to answer is, what actually causes a consumer, customer, to purchase something, to make a decision to choose this option over all other available options? And his conclusion was it wasn't anything about their demographics or even necessarily their psychographics, things that we typically gather in our data crunching, but it was, in essence, they're trying to make progress on something that they're struggling with. We call this a job. They're trying to get a job done. And the progress that they're trying to make has, again, very little to do with their demographics and everything about the function that they want to achieve, the progress they want to make. We think it can be captured if you're looking for the struggles people are trying to make progress with, the jobs, rather than looking at numbers.
You know, and I think that's fascinating because there's a lot of culture around Silicon Valley where everyone sort of feels like you just have to ride the wave at just the right time, or maybe you just have to have that magical elixir of the right people coming up with the right ideas, or just getting in a room and writing stuff on the board, when in fact there's actually a real world way of, you know, connecting with the market or the people within that market to understand how they're actually trying to make progress, as you said. And by not looking at the numbers and by looking at the actual human element of it, you're able to sort of crack that code or crack that puzzle that, you know, seems to elude a lot of people who feel like they just need to throw a lot of money and a lot of people, smart people in a room and just kind of hack away at it. And then hopefully something magical comes out of it. But in fact, there's actually a way in which, you know, anyone can who has the resources, intelligence, and diligence to pursue a new market or tackle a problem actually has a framework to work off of. And I think along those lines, there was an interesting book that just came out that I think really supports jobs theory quite profoundly, and it's called Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. Now, it's funny that the author's name is also Christian as well. What's your take on that idea that big data has failed a lot of businesses who have tried to extract the value from it that would then sort of spur on what they felt, which is either process innovation or new product innovation or new insights that would really sort of power that next wave of profitability. And kind of what you see, what would you say to that idea that kind of those companies really need to move away from that promise of big data and actually reconnect with individuals within their markets?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges of big data is not that it's useless. It's useful. It's directionally useful, but it doesn't get you all the way there to the causal mechanism. Again, why people make the choices that we do. You can slice and dice things and almost will yourself to see patterns in it that may or may not be there or may be there, but don't answer the question why. And unless you really walk in your customers' or prospective customers' shoes and understand all the things that data may not capture, again, how are they feeling? What is the social component? What's the emotional component of what they're trying to accomplish? Unless you know all of that and can picture it, in my mind, it's almost like a mini documentary. Like, who are they? What are they doing right now? What happened before? What else is in the scene?
I like
unless
that.
You
I think
have
that's a great
all of that.
Mini documentary.
It's a good way to think about it because it forces you to capture much more than just kind of little bits of information. It's a whole context, and a documentary is far more powerful than a written description of something so often. So to me, what happens is it becomes seductive that the answers are all there if we just look hard enough. And I think you're missing. It's sort of looking with blinders on if you don't look at the full context, again, of the struggle, what really matters to them in that struggle, what they really care about, and how they ultimately make this decision that they make.
You know, I'm seeing a fantastic article called The Documentary Filmmaker's Guide to Innovation. I think that would be something great. So I'll just put a pin in that for right now. There's a great example that you put forward in the book that goes along that lines where, you know, my name is, you know, Joe, and I'm, you know, 52, and I live in, you know, Pennsylvania, and I drive like a BMW. And the example of the book is different. But what do those things have to do with me buying the New York Times on a Saturday? And I think that's the trap that a lot of businesses fall into. They feel like if there's enough data, and this the author makes this point too in Sense Making, which really supports the jobs theory idea. People feel like if there's just enough data, that just magical insights will just fall out of it. And he felt that there was that danger in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that, like you said, big data has its uses, you know, its directional uses, but if just by gathering lots and lots of data, people shouldn't expect insights to magically fall out or shouldn't feel like innovation to magically be born from that. And I think documentary filmmaking is a much better way to view the way or the process by which you can kind of reach those insights rather than just collecting massive amounts of data. Have you seen, since the book's come out, have you seen a shift at all in that idea? Or do you feel like we're still in the early cycles of people still trying to extract the value out of, you know, large data lakes that they've invested in?
Well, yes and yes. I think it is. It's seductive for a reason, especially if you're a left brain person, to think that there's hard science to being able to figure out. Ever since Moneyball, that's, you know, the movie and the book, you know, we all want to will ourselves to thinking there's a Moneyball formula for getting this right. I know I did when I was the editor of Harvard Business Review. I kept thinking there's got to be a Moneyball piece of data that tells us who subscribes and resubscribes. And that if we can just, you know, master that, then we can increase our subscriptions even more. And the answer is you can. Unless you have the full context of the people. And there may be very different people with very different Moneyball stats that do things for completely different reasons. So I think people, it's a leap for people to let go of the comfort of data. But we have seen and talked to lots of really interesting organizations since the book came out who are making that leap and just saying, let's go all in. Let's figure out how to do this so that we can truly deeply understand our customers and what jobs they're hiring for. And when you talked about Silicon Valley sort of being seduced by, you know, cool and more technology, that's the struggle, because the job to be done for the engineers and the marketing people and all the brilliant people who work in these companies may be different. Personally, I want to develop these cool things. I know I can make it faster, you know, stronger, more storage, whatever. But if your customers don't value those things, if they're not directly addressing better the job they're hiring your product to do, you're not going to achieve anything. In fact, you may even risk losing those customers when a better solution comes up. Oftentimes, the better solution is not more complicated, is not more sophisticated technology. It's clarity and fewer things really squarely aimed at the job to be done.
You know, and I think that's a fascinating point, because I think people, and in much the same way that the innovator's dilemma sort of outlines it, people, they don't fail necessarily for doing the wrong thing. They're always doing the right thing. They're trying to listen to their customers. They're writing everything down. They're trying to figure out what new knobs to put on, how much more storage, like you said, somebody needs. But ultimately, it's one small piece of the entire puzzle. And those parts are important, and they are, you know, it's not wrong to do those things, I think, as you put forth in the book. But losing sight of the whole picture, just realizing you need to take a step back and realize that's not the whole picture. There's actually a lot more information that you need to be gathering, and you don't need to spend all your time, you know, figuring out all the quantitative data, and more time with the qualitative data. You brought up a good anecdote about the Harvard Business Review and how to increase, you know, subscriptions. Are there ways in which that you've seen personally this jobs theory change the way that you've done things, or maybe the way that you've changed things in your professional life?
Sure. So when I was the editor of Harvard Business Review, we did a series of a research series that were effectively jobs to be done interviews. I didn't have the language at the time, but the person who did it with us was a former student of Clay's who had learned jobs to be done theories. And so I spent a lot of time silently being in a room with people talking. They were talking about where Harvard Business Review fit in their life. And I can never get out of my head, literally, the woman in San Francisco who had a really small apartment, but used a huge portion of her premium shelf space to save every physical issue of Harvard Business Review since she had subscribed. And she took that as a really important thing in her life, that was a resource for her. So I can see that now. And I know, and we've always known, but it was really good confirmation that people actually value having HBR, not just for the month, but for the long term, because there are articles they want to read again and references and things that are really important to them. That makes you think differently about everything, how you label the cover, what you put in the marketing, what you put on the website. You think about the fact that this woman cares about it enough that in her really small apartment, it took premium real estate. There are a whole bunch of decisions that come out of that you would never, ever capture again in a piece of data.
What was some of the learning that kind of were born out? Did you like, once you found that little bit of information, you found that one person who, you know, who had that interesting story, did that change the way that you approached other customers and the way that you sort of approached the information that you got from them and kind of, you know, change that perspective? Because I had this feeling when you start implementing this, and maybe you've had these stories as well with the companies you work with, once they start getting that first bit of information, that qualitative bit of information, does that just really just transforms the way that they engage with their clients and their potential customers moving forward? Is that something that not just changes how they produce the product, but now all of a sudden you see things that you just never would have seen before, and now you know what questions to ask?
I think so. And I know for companies we've talked to, you know, beyond my own experience, what becomes really powerful is that it's a concept that is easily shared within the company. So you don't have to be the only person who was in that room seeing the use of the shelf space, but you come back and talk about the fact that what was so important was the longevity of it and pride of place, and she took us into the room to talk about it and show it to us. That becomes part of the picture you put together and share with everybody, that having Harvard Business Review as a long-term resource is extremely important to them, and you start to build a job to be done for certain people. Different people hire it for different reasons, but I think when you can capture those observations and insights in a way that's part of your description of the job and share it within the company, everybody's, you know, singing off the same hymn page. You know, you all know what you're aiming for, and you're not unintentionally contradicting each other or working across purposes or coming up with personas that don't reflect real people. You're actually working off of the job, which you can all agree on, and it becomes your kind of North Star for making every decision, from, you know, what you produce to how you talk about it to how you serve them to how you bill people. Every part of that is taken into account when you all have a very clear understanding of the job to be done.
I think you mentioned one thing in there, which was personas, which I think is always vexing for a lot of different companies, elusive as well. And there was a great article called The Marketing Malpractice that was in the Harvard Business Review that talked about sort of the misuse of personas. And how do you think that use of personas actually really sort of does a disservice when done outside of this jobs theory framework?
Well, personas focuses on who the person is, right? That's the idea. We're trying to come up with an average of a lot of people that might average out as an intellectual, or Tommy Bahama. Right. You know, that's a great persona for a company. But that gives you an image of the person, which is helpful. But it's back to your New York Times example. That person may, on different days, for different reasons and different contexts, make completely different choices about what product or service to purchase. And if you don't understand that, the persona doesn't give you enough information to make really good decisions about what matters and what doesn't matter in crafting your innovation or improving your innovation. And you can just get to an average, which some people might like, but a whole lot of people might not, because it's just an average.
So that's more of the one size fits none conundrum.
Exactly. The article you mentioned was written by Clay, and it was, I think, the original article that revealed the jobs to be done theory. Scott Cook of Intuit was one of the co-authors of that, and he has really used jobs to be done theory in Intuit in really powerful ways. And he's a great example in a technology space of understanding and making sure they're making as many good choices as possible around the job to be done.
And one of the barriers, I think, is that it seems so insurmountable to be able to go and find enough people to learn enough jobs or learn enough contextual information to be able to build that. What would you say to somebody who says, you know what, we're a small startup, or even we're a mid-sized company, we just don't have the resources, we don't have the capabilities to go out and find enough people to do interviews and, you know, create this documentary of each of their lives so that we can really kind of, you know, get down to the core of the job that needs to be done?
Well, Bob Mesta, who is one of the co-originators of this idea, he's a consultant who came to Clay with the question that they together wrestled into jobs to be done theory a long time ago. This is what he does all the time. And I know he would say you don't need to do that many interviews to recognize patterns. 10 or 20 will start to get you in a place where you start to see those stories and see if there are interesting things popping up. This doesn't require hundreds and thousands. That's the point. It's not about washing it into averages. It's about really seeing deeply in all of its kind of rich complexity jobs for real people and starting to see if there are patterns in those or jobs that you begin to personally relate to. If you have the job in your life, it's too. Other people do too. It doesn't take as many as you think. It just takes a complete sort of focus on truly identifying the job and not going in with a preconceived notion about what it is and hoping it will, you know, you can kind of cram it in to fit your version of what you want to do to innovate.
To wrap up this idea, what do you think the biggest gain would be, let's say, if Silicon Valley took this, you know, idea or this culture of, you know, innovation is just luck and we're all just trying to hack through it, to there's actually a scientific or programmatic way in which to approach a new or innovative or even just a process-driven innovation?
Oh, I think there's freeing of resources in really valuable ways. I think if you stop sort of running on treadmills trying to come up with, of all these things we're going to try, some of this will stick and then we'll figure out what to pour more resources into. This actually should be a better use of resources, because it may take a little more front end to decide and be clear what's the job to be done. And so what does that tell us matters and what doesn't matter? What's in the box and what's not in the box? But once you're there, then I think you're in a much clearer position to innovate quickly after that. So to me, it's a really potentially valuable freeing of resources. And I also think it has the potential to be really sort of intellectually stimulating to people, developers and engineers and people who give me a meaty challenge. Maybe I'll figure out how to do it better as opposed to just letting my imagination wander. That's good. But if you want a meaty challenge, it might be really hard, but you set somebody's mind in a really focused way. I think you can get great things. I think you can get the best of their energy on something that you all agree is important, and that's more likely to pay off.
Well, Karen, fantastic discussion. I appreciate you exploring the jobs theory with us. And I would encourage everyone to go out, get the book, Competing Against Luck. Karen Dillon, thank you for joining the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Next, I catch up with Gabriel Chapman at Bacon is King on the Twitters, where we actually hash out a little bit about go-to-market, how the sausage is made, and how luck shouldn't be a part of go-to-market. Gabe, how you doing?
Hey there.
So Gabe, where you been? I mean, a lot of people on the show have been around the world. You know, other people have been in Poland, New York.
Oh yeah.
Asia. Where have you been local lately, or are you bouncing around the world somewhere?
I've been bouncing around a lot. So now this is June 6th. I can actually talk freely about what I've been doing for the last pretty much 8 months. Talking about, you know, obviously I was part of SolidFire. We got acquired by NetApp. And for the last, you know, I'd say almost 8 months to a year, I've been working on the launch of NetApp's hyperconverged infrastructure solution. You know, I work with a core group of team and experts with inside the company to craft, build a product, focus on the go-to-market strategy. There's a whole lot of stuff that goes into how a sausage is made for bringing a product to market. It's been a very huge eye-opener to me. There's a significant amount of learning that takes place during this, and it's a lot of people working behind the scenes that don't get a whole lot of glory. You know, the VPs get up and do their, the VPs all get up at the launch and talk about the stuff. And then there's this whole army of people that sit behind them that have been spending, you know, pretty much 18 to 20 hours a day for the last 6 months, you know, rushing to get this thing, you know, get things out. And it's the unsung heroes of
you mean
product development.
The VP doesn't bring up all 20 people onto the stage, Gabe?
No, they normally don't. It tends to be the CEO and his VPs, and they all kind of get up there and do their thing. And, you know, this is not a bitter thing at all. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where it's like when you get so personally invested in the success of bringing something to market, you know, the recognition of that is something that sometimes gets lost for the people. So it's like, I always try to make sure that people on my team get a lot of like, hey, you know what, I love what you're all doing. I love the sacrifice. I appreciate it greatly. There needs to be more of that, because it tends to follow, you know, there's kind of these different routes. You have the marketing team, you have product management, you have product management marketing, you have engineering, you have field, you have channels, you have, you know, pricing strategy and support and all of these people. And there's so much work goes into actually building and bringing something to the market. It's quite fascinating.
And I don't think a lot of people understand sort of what goes into that. And working for a company like, you know, like you work for with a complex, you know, launch for go to market with just a lot of things at stake. And I think people don't see that part of sort of that the innovation and continued, you know, continuing innovation. And it's not, and it, you can't apply sort of luck to it. There has to be a methodical, you know, approach, a methodology that's applied, because you have so many people involved. And it's not like, well, let's just throw 10 things up on the wall and see what sticks. It's like, no, you got to get the whole army behind one idea to make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the big thing right there, is that there is a significant amount of work that goes into this. And I think the thing I'm envious about is when you're at a startup, you're singularly focused on a single product and everybody is rowing the boat together. When you work for a larger company that has a portfolio of products, that's when all of a sudden things get a little bit different. There are competing interests, there's competing BUs, there's all kinds of shit. So it's like when I look at, you know, somebody like the Dell EMC merger, or, you know, Cisco bringing different companies on, or HP bringing these other products on, that's a bigger challenge than I think a lot of people understand as well, that integration point. But also, like I said, coming in and saying, oh, not invented here, is a big issue. And I think that's a big issue for a lot of organizations, and it's something that everybody has to work through. And I just think, you know, it's a challenge, and it definitely makes your job, it can make your job harder. And I think when you see organizations that have been very successful with integrations of technology they've acquired, what you start to see is that it takes him 4 or 5 or 20 times to do it and to do it well. And, you know, there's no recipe for this. I mean, Cisco was always really good at, you know, MPLS, that team was really good about buying technologies and bringing them into the fold at Cisco and leveraging them. But for a lot of other organizations who may do one acquisition every 2 to 3 years or 5 years, you know, the muscle memory associated with that goes away. And so now you have to kind of, every time you do it, it's, you have to restart and redo the whole thing. And the same thing happens for launching a product. If you have an organization that has been primarily focused on, you know, one set of products or one focus of products, when they bring another solution in that might be outside the norm, there's a whole new process. It's like, oh, how do we launch this again? How do we integrate these teams? How do we make sure that people, you know, are compensated? How do we make sure that we understand what the partner's needs are and what the selling motion looks like? I mean, it's a monumental undertaking, and frankly, I'm surprised that any merger is successful having gone through it.
There's so much to go, and there's so many ways to fail and so few ways to succeed in that instance. And you feel like it has to be in the DNA of the leadership within a company, and because I mean, there is a little bit of component of luck in it, because there's a certain group of people that starts on the journey when that acquisition happens, and it's not the same group of people at the end of the journey. Have you seen that sort of attrition and that change where there was a singular vision at the beginning, or an idea of how that new company and the new technology was going to get folded in and integrated, but then it changed and shift because the team changed?
I think, yeah, there's a couple aspects to that. So no organization that gets acquired should expect everyone to come over and be happy. You're going to see some form of attrition, and sometimes that attrition can happen up front. Like you saw with Simplivity, HP cut a lot of the people out of the equation right at the beginning. Some other organizations wait and do it down the road because they don't want to interrupt the flow of business. There are strategies around that. There are tax strategies around that. There's a whole bunch of different angles into how to integrate those and how it can disrupt or influence the flow of sales for a given quarter. The timing of it isn't always perfect, you know, and there's so much that goes into the thinking behind that. When a merger happens, expect to lose people. Expect things to be kind of wonky, expect it to be painful. But at the end of the day, you know, the reality is it's all part of the process. And, you know, what I'm saying is probably something that's not anything new to people who've been through an acquisition before.
So now that you're on the other side of the sausage making factory and you've seen everything that goes into it, and then you see the sausage that comes out on the other side, is there anything you would do different, or anything you would tell someone who's just kind of at the beginning of that road, who's about to kind of start putting the sausage ingredients in together to make the sausage? What advice or warnings would you provide them, saying, hey, look, these are top 10 things or top 3 things that you just shouldn't do, or you should make sure they're...
I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, first and foremost, ownership is probably the biggest. Ownership of a plan. So you need a benevolent dictator, in my viewpoint, to do this properly. So you need somebody who can come in and drive all facets of the go-to-market motion. Right, that could be a project manager or whatever you want to call that person, but you need
the czar of GTM.
You need a product czar, right? Somebody, and it can't just be product management, right? So product management has a specific part to play, and then everybody has a little part to play. Sometimes and you look at it this way: if it was left to engineering, it would never get out the door because they like perfect is better than done, and for most of us, done is better than perfect. So, there's that challenge, right? It's like, oh, well,
perfect is the enemy of the good challenge.
Exactly. And then there's marketing people who just, hey, we need to tell a story. We need to dedicate all these people to get this product out there. Then you have the field people who have experience in that space. And, it's a massive battle for mind share, because everybody wants to have their information. Everybody wants to have their point of view take precedence. And what you need is somebody to come in there and herd those cats and make sure that everything is tied together and that it's defined. And that if you set dates and timelines for things, that they're held accountable to them. I think that's probably the biggest challenge that it faces a product as it's being cobbled together and launched. Primarily because it's a big issue. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on, and there are people who, they have their frame of reference is just their immediate world around them, but then there's a whole bunch of other stuff that they think they know about, but they just don't, right? And so lean on those subject matter experts from those other verticals to really help and facilitate what you're doing. That's, a big thing, getting that stuff dialed up and getting ramped up and getting ready to go. You know, it's pretty amazing.
That's fantastic. So good chat today, Gabe. sounds like you've been incredibly busy. You're finally on the other side of the tunnel. You've seen the light now, and maybe you'll actually have a little bit more time to throw back a couple beers and then sort of reap the benefits. But I now imagine now that you're on the other side of the sausage making, there's a whole lot more work to be done. You got to go out there and get people on board.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the making the sausage is just the part, the first part. Now I got to go sell it and then eat it.
Ah. Some good sausage on some V.
Hey, hopefully we get to the point where it's like, you know, hey, it's you know, sausage fest. It's a sausage party, right?
That'll be so I'm
come
looking forward
down
to that event, the NetApp Sausage Fest. Have that sometime somewhere in the valley sometime. Let me know.
Have you not been to any tech conference? all kidding right aside, though, it's hey, by the way, I'm hiring.
Excellent. Gary Chapman, hiring. All right, great chat today.
Thanks, Porter.
Next, I sit down with Josh Atwell, at Josh underscore Atwell. Make sure you include the underscore. Developer advocate at NetApp to talk about some of the dysfunction in technology companies. We've all experienced our own that really hampers their ability to achieve true innovation. Josh, welcome to the show.
More than happy to be here.
You've had a lot of experience seeing dysfunction in organizations, siloed organizations, and people getting entrenched in bad habits and the way they've done things before, which really hampers true innovation and stifles companies. What are some of the experiences you feel like are probably the biggest hurdles for companies to really overcome? And companies are just a collection of people, and those people are imperfect. And where do you see the biggest problems in some of the sort of the tribal dysfunctions that really hamper companies from really moving to that truly innovative quadrant?
I'd like to start by leading with an example that isn't so negative sounding, right? You know, when we think about dysfunction leading to hindering innovation, it sounds like people are nefariously trying to stifle it. One thing that I think that we have to be aware of, especially within the IT industry and the technology industry, is that a lot of times we get ingrained in our trenches. We have our little ruts that we've developed, and we've optimized for a process, and we've worked really hard to improve that process without ever actually asking if maybe we should change the process or the scope of the process. And so I think that the lack of inquisitive nature of asking, like, why do we do this? The natural response is that, well, that's how we do things. I run into frequently where new people come into an organization and say, this is how you do something. They're like, well, yeah, but why don't we do it like that instead? And the general response will be somewhere along the lines of, well, there's a lot to it, but you know, this is the best that we were able to determine. And it kind of dies right there. And I think that's like this point of where innovation dies. You know, when you get new perspectives and new viewpoints, you know, that person may have had a new technology that they had worked with that could help solve problems that you've already glossed over. So not necessarily something nefarious or something that people are being holding onto their own. Because I think that's the other side of it.
No, I like almost like that mental image of, you know, of that culture where innovation goes to die. And maybe that's a good way to look at it. And I like the spin, not so negative. People aren't trying to stifle innovation. But like you said, when you get an agreement, when culture kind of culminates into everyone finally rowing in the same direction, and people come in and there's not constantly that that storming mentality or that conflict, and you finally have sort of the norming phase where everyone's like, good, I know what to expect when I come in. I don't have conflict. Everyone's moving in the same direction. Why do I want to disturb that? Why do I want to get outside of that? And when people come in and ask why, it starts to become, well, now you're going to make me change again. And of course, as everyone knows, everyone hates change. People want to come in. I mean, people want to excel. They want to perform really well. But to your point, they also don't want to constantly have to reinvent everything that they're doing. They want to kind of coalesce around something, feel like they've accomplished something, put a process in place, and then follow that.
Yeah, and that definitely leads into, I think, what we're seeing in the market and in our industry, where, you know, as technology continues to evolve, and it evolves very, very quickly, our ability to be comfortable in our processes and the way things we've done before becomes something that you can't hold on to. Right? It becomes very, very slippery, like sand in your hands. And we actually have to function with more agility. And I think when you look at methodologies and movements like DevOps and getting those incorporated into a culture or into a company, it's really about forcing innovation to some degree, or at least bringing to light the need that we have to innovate. What we have been doing has served fine. And I know that everybody did the best that they could with how we were structured and with what we were doing. But now we have to reevaluate what we've been doing. Our criteria has changed, and other people have proven that we can do much better, not just a little bit better, not like marginally better, but factors like magnitudes more than what we've been doing. And because we are required to go down that path, so we must innovate and change the way we've done things, and B, we've actually seen that people can do it. So we know it's possible. It's like with science. When somebody shows that it's possible for something to happen, they can figure out how it works and how it was made to happen and can repeat it. And so I think that is one of those areas where we have this opportunity now to break up that disruption to innovation.
I'm glad you brought that point up, because that really feels like the cornerstone of Clayton Christensen's argument in disruptive innovation, was that people kept doing the same thing, and it wasn't wrong. In fact, they were hailed as the leaders of their industry and fantastic leaders at that, because they always did the smart thing. They did the right thing, but then they were disrupted by other companies that looked at it differently and said, no, we're going to do something different. We're going to service a different market. We're going to service it in a different way. And we're going to turn the industry on its head by not doing what you think is the right thing to do.
Or the safe bet, even. We get very comfortable with identifying what the safe bet is and what the safest course of action. And that is not what generally leads to growth and innovation. That's usually what allows you to put something on the back burner and not have to give it your full attention for a period of time, which then I think, again, going to the fact that I don't think this is some negative, nefarious plot by people. I just think it's our tendency that once we feel that something is stable and it's where it needs to be, that we move on to something else.
And I think that the desire for stability really creates what you were chatting about earlier, which was people just wanting to take that incremental approach. And you're going to get that same incremental result with that same mentality. What you really want is that exponential return on investment, or you want to take that risk to not just, let's increase, X metric by 0.285%. No, let's actually grow by a factor of 125% and look at things that way. And even if you don't hit that 125%, you're going to hit somewhere in between 0.28% and 125%. It's going to be a lot better. And if it does fail, the opportunity cost is, maybe you don't make that 0.285%, but I think people get caught in this cycle of feeling like they're doing the right thing, focusing on the safe bet, and being happy with incremental returns, when in fact exponential shouldn't just be what you strive for as an innovator. It should be really what you just strive for as an individual who's trying to perform. And I think that bar should be set a little bit differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this goes back to a lot of the people who would be identified as innovators are ones who recognize that something, orders of magnitude needed to be done, and were willing to completely discard the considered norms of how that should have been accomplished, really dive into what was the real objective and look for different methodologies and capabilities. I think we're going to continue to see this get injected into specifically the IT industry and technology in general, and the way that businesses go to market, the way that individuals even grow their own professional growth and career, the way that developers interact with the world. These are all things that as someone recognizes that it's possible to do it different, it kind of changes the mentality of how to approach those problems, to where now you have this amazing optimism of, I can make all these changes and do this. And to your point, if you fall a little bit short, then you still made a considerable impact.
So just to kind of end on one final thought, what do you think could be sort of like the biggest change or first step that, as you mentioned, that individuals within a company can start to do in order to maybe start building real momentum to move an organization in a particular direction that gets it out of that incremental mentality to that exponential risk-taking mentality?
I think the number one thing is changing the mindset of when approached. For instance, if you take into consideration, if someone in your leadership or one of your peers asks the question, why are we doing it this way? Why does it take so long? Why does it require this? they're asking that not because they're wanting to do extra work. They're asking it because they've identified that as a point where improvement would make a sizable impact or increase into something else that is in the environment or is necessary for the business. So I think the number one first step is that people need to stop and ask, well, why do you ask? Like, why is that important? Like, what is it about that, you know, leads you to ask that question? Because if we just immediately shut it down and say, no, this is as fast as we can ever get it, then you lose that opportunity to identify the relative importance of making that change or innovating in that space and changing the way that you do things. And as such, you create a culture of people all up the stack, believing that it's the only way it can be done. When in fact, there are probably numerous different ways that you could tackle that problem that would have strong appreciable impacts to other areas within the IT organization or the business.
And I would have to agree with that. Josh, I appreciate you joining the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Research for this podcast was powered by Sprinklr, the social media management platform. To find out more about them, you can go to sprinklrwithnoe.com. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice and leave us a review if you will. It helps others find us. Also, we love hearing from you, the listeners, your story ideas, your thoughts on the tech world, and what you're doing as well, so that we can make this show as relevant to your daily tech life as possible. So hit us up on Twitter using hashtag InTechWeTrust. We'll be checking that daily to start conversations, engage with people, and get your thoughts. You can also follow us at InTech_WeTrust and give us your thoughts there as well. See you next time. Oh.